Many of you know Mark personally. You know him as the founder of APN, and some of him know him as an academic at Queens College of the City University of New York. Mark also directs the Center for Jewish Studies at Queens College, and he also directs the Center for Ethnic and Racial Tolerance there at Queens College. Those of you who have joined us in the past on APN's Israel Study Tours also know Mark as the leader of those tours. And this is perhaps a good opportunity to remind you that Mark will also be leading our tour, our 2013 tour, this November, between November 2nd and 8th. Registration for is still open, although not for long. We have only a handful of spots still available. So if you're interested in joining the tour, you can find information on our website, or you can contact me at onir at peacenow.com. So without further ado, Mark Rosenblum, the floor is yours.
And I think that your introduction about the VAR was appropriate. I guess I just came back from, well, I don't guess. I really just did come back from nearly a month in the Middle East, of which 3 weeks was devoted to leading a young group of student scholars, undergraduate Muslim, Jewish, and Christian, highly motivated and highly academically honored. These are students around the country that competed to get into a program, and I was with them in Saudi Arabia, in Israel, in Oman, in the Emirates, and Amman, Jordan, in the Palatory territories. It was a whirlwind, and I left with the attitude that I was going to the Muddle East, and I came back still feeling it's very muddled, and I don't pretend to have very many answers, and it was nice for Ori to raise your expectations of getting something counterintuitive. I'm still in the midst of sorting this whirlwind out in my own mind. And the only thing that I'm convinced of is that we are in the midst of a violent and tumultuous transition in the Middle East, and it's a protracted one. And the tipsy-turvy notion of what happens from 1 week or one day to the next day leads to incredible transformations and having to recalibrate what we thought was happening. For example, we just witnessed in the last 4 or 5 days a profound change in what was the smart and perhaps smart alecky thinking. In retrospect, it was smart alecky thinking that the Arab Spring that was started with so much hope, with a young rebellion against repressive oligarchic regimes and gerontocracies throughout the Arab world, and we thought that there was a great opening here, the aperture for democratic transformation and the street talking for inclusion as full citizens reigning in their leaders. And then it became popular wisdom that this rather romantic reading of the Arab Spring in its initial period had turned into a very cynical view in the eyes of many in the West, and the Arab Spring had sprung into a Muslim and Islamic winter that was characterized in draconian terms. And now we've seen what happened to Morsi in Egypt, and the Brotherhood has been deposed by a combination of popular demand, unprecedented in Egyptian politics probably, the biggest demonstrations yet to be seen, and also followed now by seemingly a massacre, and the authority here, it's a massacre of, 50 or more Egyptians who were responding to the demoralizing of Morsi that was supporting the Muslim Brotherhood, and the behavior of the police and the military was not exactly what one would have hoped for or expected. And we don't know what's happening in Egypt other than that the Brotherhood has suffered a calamitous development, and there's all kinds of now easy thinking about what this means. I'm not sure what it means yet. I've been wrong, and other people have been wrong with such frequency. The one thing I start with for the next, and end with hopefully in the next 15, 20 minutes, is a sense of humility about what I'm about to say. I don't have certitude here. I have just a sense that we're we can't capture what's happening through still frame photography. We're watching a movie here, and I can't imagine that the movie has even an ending that's been scripted, much less filmed. So I think we're flying by the seat of our pants, but the most judicious observations I made at this stage, first I'll start with reminding us that the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is engulfed in a much broader drama that it is a part of. And I'll say a few things about that drama. I did spend a week of time that doesn't make me even an armchair scholar about Saudi Arabia. But I did understand that while we did not have forthright, direct, open conversations with Saudi leadership about, so what are the Saudis going to do in the midst of this storm, I think it's clear to suggest that this might be a Saudi moment, a very important one. We've heard a lot from Peace Now and other groups on the interesting and important role the Saudis played in articulating and help push for the Arab Peace Initiative. And that peace initiative hasn't ever been endorsed publicly by an Israeli government and embraced as a basis for pursuing some negotiations, including clarifying a lot of the elements of the Saudi Peace Initiative that desperately need clarification. And I think that, I did not have contacts with people directly in the royal family or the foreign ministry while I was in Saudi Arabia, there is certainly a sense that the Saudis understand there's a moment here, and they seemingly have seized the moment, at least financially, in making our reading about now the $8 billion loan guarantee, or it seems like it's loans. It may end up being a mix of grants and loans, along with Kuwait trying to prop up the new government, whatever the new government is. It's very much in transition. I remind all of us again that this transitional moment is unclear, other than that 17 million Egyptians took to the streets and demanded the resignation of Morsi and got it, and that the army now is in the process of establishing a transition government. They've chosen or appointed Justice Adli Mansour, who is a well-known judge and head of the Supreme, equivalent of the Supreme Court in that country. And this transition period is charged with establishing a transition government and forming a committee to draft changes in a constitution and preparing Egypt for, I think, what will be parliamentary and then presidential elections, all within 6 months. A very fast train again. This allow the people in Egypt that made this particular revolt, the young people that formed and have been working in the streets now to effectively get rid of the Morsi regime. But it's not likely the Muslim Brotherhood will go into the night quietly on this. It's a very dangerous precedent, one could argue, of having Muslim authorities and governments elected in fair and free elections, then deposed forcefully. This may empower those in the very complicated and diverse Muslim world to believe that they can't gain power through democratic, fair, and open elections, which sets up a very nasty prospect of perhaps enhanced resistance and violence. The Saudis have now jumped in and provided some economic relief to the new government, to the military, and to the president of the country and the vice president of the country, who we all know has been appointed. And there's a rather complicated process that will be rolled out in this transition period of the Saudis seemingly are engaged in it and see this as an opportunity to struggle against the Muslim Brotherhood with the Emirates. And the Emirates themselves, in several of those city-states, city-nations, have been accusing the Muslim Brotherhood of engaging in violence and trying to sabotage their own governments in the Emirates. So there's a strong anti-Muslim Brotherhood tendency that the Saudis are trying to help mobilize and save Egypt from the economic catastrophe that awaits it without very dramatic economic reforms, to say the least. And the Saudis seem to be playing a role here. And can this role be not only to prop up this Egyptian government economically and assist it with financial largesse, are they also willing to pursue in the light of day the Arab League Peace Initiative? And here I want to emphasize the significance of the Arab Peace Initiative, but also offer the hope without illusion, because there still is a lot of confusion about what has been said most recently. That's very important. We know that two very important ranking officials that are now ex-officials from Qatar came to the United States, rewarded Kerry with a clarification that the Arab League Peace Initiative was not just talking about the 67 borders, end of discussion, but they embraced for the first time and clarified that the borders the Saudis were talking about were borders that would not exactly be the 67 borders. They would be mutually agreed changes. The famous swaps were included in this. And everyone, including our friends like Akiba Eldar, insisted we now had a further moderate clarification, and all was said and done properly, and we could move on. Well, it turns out that there are other members of the Arab League that said this was done out of order, and this can only be done by the foreign ministers themselves. And maybe Ori can clarify, because I'm not sure whether there was a formal seconding of what the Qatari officials said in Washington in clarifying that the borders they had in mind be mutually negotiated with swaps that would be modest that both parties would agree to. I don't know that that's clean and final. I think there are a lot of things yet to be clarified. But the Saudis, I think, understand that there's a moment here for them to really put together a coalition in the Arab and Muslim world that can counter their primary rival, and that is the Iranians. More on the confusion in the Middle East and the Arab conflicts that are taking place outside of the Arab world, there's something very important that's happened that also should capture our attention, and that's in Iran. We now have a new president that was fairly and openly elected, and that in his infinite wisdom, the supreme leader decided to let that election stand as legitimate, a much wiser move than Morsi made, and Morsi insisted on apparently a non-inclusive direction that did not bring in other important forces into the government. And now what seems to be emerging in Iran is a relatively moderate regime that has made all kinds of bold promises to deal with the poor in Iran and deal with the economic crisis in Iran, to deal with the global sanctioning of Iran in a way that is open to a diplomatic initiative. So I'd say one of the most dramatic things happening in the Middle East today, broadly speaking, in the Arab and the Muslim Middle East, is Egypt and Iran, that's hopeful, is the diplomatic opportunities that prevail now in avoiding what many anticipated as a grim nuclear fall and a showdown between the Israelis and the Iranian presumed quest for acquiring nuclear weapons. While many in the American Jewish community may remind us that the new president of Iran also has a track record in the nuclear question and comes from the inner sanctum of the religious community in Iran, nevertheless, clear that he represents a different tendency. And I'd suggest that Washington at this stage and Israel ought to be examining the diplomatic openings that now exist and working in Egypt, and the Egyptian military has to be leaned on pretty heavily to make sure that their program takes place in a timely fashion and that this is not simply a new military grab for power. They really have no choice but to do what they did. That can be argued, and clearly this is a coup of sorts, but with very strong popular mass backing. I remind us, myself in particular, that on January the 25th, 2009, 7 million Egyptians, most of them urban, young, middle class, very educated folks, were in the streets demanding the resignation of Mubarak. And we saw then the military stepping up and siding with the street. I think something similar has happened this time as well, with the military siding with the 17 million Egyptians that took to the streets, trying to force the resignation of the democratically elected successor, Mohamed Morsi. So the real question here is how quickly and how honorably are the Egyptian military, Sisi, the leader of the Egyptian army, with the transitional authorities now in place, going to really move towards an inclusive government? And it's got to include the Brotherhood in this diplomatic moment. To think about excluding half of the country or close to that, and trying to stabilize a polity, and talk about empowering its citizenship, is a grand illusion. And anyone that believes it can be done to the exclusion of the Islamic population is foolhardy. For the moment, we should notice that the segment of the Islamic party community that's involved and has supported this, at least tentatively, al-Nur is a Salafist movement that is traditionally much more hardline and less pragmatic than the Muslim Brotherhood. So it's a fascinating mix of marriages and fusions of interest in Egypt. And I think that Washington's great challenge and Israel's great challenge is to not buy the illusions that you can exclude the Islamist tendency in Egypt from governance and from stabilization, or that you can ignore what has just happened in Iran and reject the current new president as just one of the gang of hardliners that will never negotiate in good faith. These would be two terrible mistakes to not understand the diplomatic moment. Quickly on to the Israeli-Palestinian dimension and how these issues, both Iran and Egypt, play into it. It's clear that we have a good deal of cynicism that I experienced in the Israeli and the Palestinian streets vis-a-vis Kerry. He's thought of as a sort of Don Quixote-like figure. He's very quixotic, not understood as why he's going on this hobby horse, this chase, with what is thought of as the Three Stooges. It's Kerry with almost a heroic sense of naivety, is a view you commonly hear from Israelis and from Palestinians. And you think of the Three Stooges, and this is the way it was characterized to me. The President of the United States is really not going to buy into this. He maybe has an emissary, popular opinion suggests, and carry the envoy. But the President's really not very visible presence in all of this, or non-presence in this, makes them believe that he understands that he isn't going to be able to deliver Netanyahu. Bibi is the same Bibi, and that the Palestinians are hopelessly divided between two territorial and ideological tendencies, and both are weak, and particularly it's presumed that Mahmoud Abbas is a very weak president and is not about to go for anything less than the 67 borders and a Palestinian state with a lot of guarantees from Washington that they believe Washington will not give. So the Three Stooges notion is that we have a president of the United States, a president of Palestine, and a prime minister of Israel that are not equipped for the kind of breakthrough that Kerry is talking about. And what I'd like to do is take a few minutes to talk about my view of Netanyahu, which is maybe a little bit of the counterintuitiveness that Ori introduced at the beginning that you might get from me. I think there arguably are three Netanyahus that have been projected by the prime minister. And it's fitting because this is his third time as prime minister. Does he think he's got a fourth in him yet? Well, I think the first Netanyahu, the first Bibi one can talk about, is the Bibi Shamir. That prime minister in his first term that looked as if he had simply taken a page, stolen a page, of Yitzhak Shamir. He was a supporter of greater Israel. He was endorsing the politics of not one inch, and he was really engaged in a transparent stalemate when it came to negotiating his first prime ministership. Beyond the Bibi Shamir, which is a man who is not willing or able to make peace, you can argue that there was a moment where he was projecting the Bibi Begin. That is Menachem Begin, you recall, while not willing to negotiate on his beloved Judea and Samaria and not willing to break from the settlement enterprise, was, we thought, prepared to perhaps make a state-to-state breakthrough, and did, with Egypt. And with that, peace, full peace in removing every Jewish settler, every Israeli soldier, returning to the international boundaries with Egypt, a precedent had been set, a state-to-state negotiating process had been culminated successfully, but it was done as an insurance policy that Begin thought he had written so he would never have to negotiate Judea and Samaria. He buried the Palestinian-Israeli negotiations forever, he presumed, by making peace separately with the Egyptians. And one believed that this was a route that Netanyahu was prepared to go down, perhaps as the prime minister his second time, that he would do the deal with Syria. And we know that he supposedly came close, but never was willing to make the final deal. And so the idea of a state-to-state negotiation to insulate himself from having to negotiate a serious breakthrough with the Palestinians never took place. So we didn't have we had the Bibi Shamir. We didn't really experience the Bibi Begin in the state-to-state deal. And we have come to understand that Netanyahu is forever stalling and walking between the raindrops and trying to present the possibility of being pragmatic, but in the end of the day, wedded to the idea of forestalling to ever pay the painful compromises that are so often talked about that any Israeli prime minister would have to make in pursuit of a real peace with the Palestinians. And then the question is raised. Today, we wake up to new news that the prime minister supposedly is agreed to some 40 Palestinians who have blood in their hands, but the blood was spilled prior to Oslo, and he's agreeing to release 40 of the 104 or so Palestinians that Mahmoud Abbas had been demanding. But the Netanyahu government and Netanyahu himself said he was against, until this recent apparent breakthrough, against any rewarding of the Palestinians of honoring pre-demands or conditions they were demanding prior to renewing negotiations. There will be no release of prisoners, was the party line. Seemingly, this has been changed. There's very serious discussion taking place and was taking place a week and a half ago when I was in Israel, where people from the left surprisingly taking another look at whether there was a fourth Netanyahu. And that Netanyahu was the Netanyahu of Sharon and Olmert. Was Bibi really prepared to negotiate based on President Barack Obama's May 2011 speech, the May 19th, 2011 speech? Was he really looking for a way of negotiating based on the 67 borders with swaps, that he would, in effect, be able to market this as not the 67 borders because he wouldn't accept the 67 borders and the Palestinians and the Arab League ostensibly? I've already now clarified that, in fact, they understood they weren't returning exactly to the 67 borders, that the settlement blocks were in play and Israel would be able to, through negotiations, negotiate an expansion that would include at least those three settlement blocks that we often hear talked about. Is Netanyahu reexamining what the world looks like and what the possibilities are? I've always been a naysayer in that. I thought we'd arrived at the notion that had been demonstrated over and over again that the prime minister was willing to project the image of a possible pragmatist who was only hamstrung by a government he unfortunately had that would not let him make the deal that he wanted to make. And so here we have a debate that's now reemerged again for the umpteenth time. Is Netanyahu seriously, plausibly doing this? Can one imagine looking for a moment at Netanyahu's current government and seeing that this government is wholly unequipped to negotiate any substantive breakthrough towards a two-state solution. If you start looking at some of the names of the people that are in the central decision-making positions outside of Zippy Livni, who he has appointed to be a negotiator, but a negotiator that at the end of the day is accountable to him, and he has populated the defense ministry with a deputy head of the defense ministry who's been in the news in the last 3 weeks disavowing his own belief in a two-state solution and suggesting that the prime minister understands a two-state solution is not going to be doable, the Palestinians will never agree to it, and he himself, Danny Danone, the deputy defense minister, is dead set against it, and Bibi will never allow a two-state solution to emerge. Zev Elkin, the deputy foreign minister, like Danny Danone, who is the deputy defense minister, believes the two-state solution is a death warrant for the state of Israel. This is another man that's committed to greater Israel, to the annexation of significant parts of the West Bank, and eschews the idea of a two-state solution as a disaster. And he is the ranking officer, arguably, the ranking head of the defense of the foreign ministry in the absence of the current official foreign minister, who, as you know, is still being investigated and has had to resign from the position. If you look at the current defense minister himself, Moshe Yaalon, you have a man who is not sympathetic to the idea of a two-state solution, certainly doesn't believe it's possible in his lifetime, and believes that the current government of the Palestinian Authority is not a partner and believes there's no plan that's been ever put together that's a plausible basis for a two-state solution. You could go on and identify the examples that make the current government that Netanyahu has put together to be a government that is not plausibly a negotiating vehicle. And then you look at his own party, and the people that I've mentioned, several of them, are members of his own party. And if you count up the 21 or so members of Likud, you would see that nearly half of them are believers in greater Israel. And then you have, of course, Naftali Bennett, who personally has had a terrible falling out with the prime minister dating back now to his last, to an earlier term. And Bennett is a central player in this government that also openly ridicules the idea of a two-state solution and sees it as a disaster and itself is for annexing significant parts of the West Bank as part of greater Israel. So just by this cursory look, one can make a case, no way, Jose. There's not a government here that's built to negotiate any significant breakthrough. Well, then we're reminded, well, there now is a safety net that's being provided for him. If Bibi really does want to make peace, we're told that the head of the Labor Party has offered herself, if he's really willing to make peace and demonstrate it, she will support the prime minister from the outside, perhaps even consider joining a real peace-making government within Israel. You also have the head of Shas and its mandates in the Knesset that have a much more moderate position associated with Derry. And Derry also might be a party to seizing the moment and a negotiating breakthrough. We're stuck with a prime minister, however, that still has a party that could break from him. So there's all this talk about the diplomatic political machinations that Bibi might be in the midst of undergoing. I'll leave it there. I don't have an answer, but at the beginning of this third term, some on the left thought there ought to be pressure put on Bibi to make peace and let him prove to us he wasn't interested. And for, I think, the better part of now a year and a half, people have presumed that he's once again shown his false face. The debate is on again, and we'll see what Kerry is able to do. I don't think it's impossible that Bibi will agree to some terms based on the May 19th presidential initiative. That is, Barack Obama is talking about borders and security arrangements first, while recognizing the core issues that need to be addressed. There is a clear focus on these two issues, and he addressed this in terms of the same language of the 67 borders with swaps, with attention to Israeli security arrangements. So I'm not going to belabor this any longer, other than ending with a quick summary of the good news that is a part of this story. And part of the story of the good news is the mobilization, but not yet total effectiveness, of a group of businessmen, both Palestinian businessmen I'm not sure if it was the business, any women that were involved in this. Maybe one of the spouses was involved in this. And you can correct me, Uri, as I wind down here. Munaf al-Masri and Yossi Vardi, two stalwarts. Masri, a billionaire member of the Palestinian Legislative Council, along with Yossi Vardi, revealed in Amman, Jordan, in May at the World Economic Forum in Amman, Jordan, lobbying their respective governments for a two-state solution and putting it in apocalyptic terms, close to now or never, this may be the last chance. They have not necessarily hung together as a group and been very effective post their appearance in their initiative as business elites for peace. But this suggests an agency that we long have talked about that has a vested interest in a dramatic breakthrough in breathing life into the two-state solution. And maybe we haven't heard the last from Munaf al-Masri and Yossi Vardi in a cooperative venture of getting the business community. We've also seen their indications from the military and security forces in Israel, not just the OC Central Command. Major General Nitzan alone has been warning about not allowing the void to be not be filled with a real diplomatic initiative and for peace and a two-state solution being pursued. And he just today has suggested again that new evidence of the last several months show a dramatic decline, a steep decline on the part of violence and stone throwing and rocks and attacks against Jewish settlers, a 70% reduction in attacks in the last 2 or 3 months, and suggests that one of the three reasons for this decline in attacks is the effective work of the Palestinian security forces. So we have between, I think, the security community and the business community, some agents of change here. The Arab Peace Initiative, I think, is still waiting for a Saudi clarification, and I think they're walking through an open door here. I would not be surprised if there's further clarification about talking about how one integrates confidence-building measures and beginning slow, gradual normalization with the State of Israel, and they clarify it's not a peace treaty that will result from Israel unilaterally getting out of all the territories since 67, and then Israel should hope that the Palestinians and the Arab world delivers their part of commitments. It has to be done mutually, together, every step of the way, and maybe the Arab League will further clarify this. There also took place just this past Sunday, I believe, a group of parliamentarians from Shas and from Likud and activists from Shas and Likud that spent the better part of an afternoon at the Mokata in Ramallah. And it's a very promising development because these are exactly the constituencies in the current Knesset, the parties of Shas and members of Likud, that would have to give the prime minister the support he claims he needs to make this breakthrough and to deliver a substantive Israeli initiative towards peace. And I think I'd also mention that as we wind down the comments now, that Kerry himself is still intending to make this sixth trip out to the Middle East. Hopefully the very difficult situation and illness of his wife will pass. And it turned out to only be a scary moment, and he will return sometime in July or August and be able to stitch together what I expect will be a renewal of negotiations. But the renewal of negotiations really can't just be a temporary facelift. It has to be something that goes to the core issues and minimally focuses on borders and security arrangements. And here the question of whether the Palestinians are able to do it, and I end with the suggestion that the diplomatic moment with Hamas is prescient. It's very, very important. Hamas has suffered a grievous setback. It started during the Israeli military operation 2 years ago. It was then intense with the break that occurred with the fall of the Morsi government, and they've lost their major supporter politically and financially, even though the Morsi government and the Muslim Brotherhood regime in Egypt did not deliver all the things that Hamas expected, and they were disappointed by Morsi's lack of sympathy towards them. They still banked on this tendency in the Islamic world. They suffered a grievous setback. So the question becomes now, do you want to have America and the Palestinians and the Israelis and the international community use this as a bit of the decline and weakness of Hamas to move towards a deal just with the Palestinian Authority and strengthening it? Or do you want to try and see if Hamas and that part of it that probably is tied to people like Ghazi Hamad in the foreign ministry that are looking for a diplomatic opening for Hamas? Americans for Peace Now is one of the few organizations that for a long time now has been talking about changing the preconditions for Hamas for entering the diplomatic process. Instead of preconditioning Hamas out of the negotiations, why not judge Hamas by its behavior? Yes, it will have to cease violence and terrorism during the negotiating period, but it should be judged by its performance if it does decide to join. The question of do we encourage a reunification between Hamas and Fatah is a very important question at the moment now, where we see Egypt having fallen into hands that are not very sympathetic to Hamas, with Hamas ostensibly under significant pressure within Gaza because of the economic crisis there, and will Hamas be integrated into a peacemaking initiative? The Saudis have a lot to say here. The Qataris have a lot to say here. Will Hamas find it is not having an opportunity to insert itself in diplomacy? Will it try and leverage itself by going back to its estranged relationship with Iran and the resistance front in the Arab world? This is a very critical question of the status of Hamas and whether a diplomatic initiative might be so bold as to include them as well. I have no inside information here. I read what most of you read as well. I know that Hamas has been often talking out of both sides of its mouth on its willingness to change its past. Mashal has to be at this stage feeling very, very weak in his latest appointment of his next term as head of Hamas now. But I think it's, again, one of those moments where diplomacy cries out for creativity and boldness. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mark. This was fascinating. I will remind people that in order to ask a question, they should dial 5-star. 5-star, that will alert me that you want to ask a question, and I will call on you. So 5-star, and I will call on you. Mark, one quick question for you I'm just curious about Saudi Arabia. When you were there, did you see any kind of evidence that there is concern in Saudi Arabia regarding the possibility of popular unrest, of turmoil, of something like a Saudi Arab Spring?
No, I think that I think they're pretty cocky for the moment about having things under control. They seem to have enough financial lubricants to co-opt and buy people off in the short run. I think there is real concern, and in some cases even near hysteria, about the longer-term process when the lubricant of oil runs out in terms of domestic politics. And also, the unknown that will be happening in the not-too-distant future when the succession to the next king, to the next prince, will not come from the current sons of the founder of the House of Saud, but will come from their sons. And there's a whole new group of Saudi princesses and royals that are going to be assuming power in the next half a decade, if not before. So I think there is crisis in terms of oil and succession that befuddle the Iranians, the Saudis, and they're very much concerned about. But for the moment, they do not see the Arab Spring metastasizing to their streets. And by the way, I was really shocked and stunned to see the overlay of modernization and what oil, income, and gas has provided for the Saudis, just in terms of the way the big cities present themselves. They don't want to talk about the royal succession issue. They don't want to talk about very much the non-nationals and the extent to which they're a floating time bomb, nor do they want to talk about that northern province where the oil comes from, where there's a Shia majority that there is a threat from. And that's been a rather continuous one, but they seem to see that as a provincial concern of a particular province.
Got it.
They don't see it having national-wide implications yet.
Got it. Thanks, Mark. We don't have much time left, so I would encourage people to ask short questions, and you, Mark, to try to answer short answers. Our first question comes from Ernie Bogan. Please go ahead, Ernie.
Hi, Mark. How are you? Hello. Hello.
Yes,
I'm
Ernie.
Here.
You're with us.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Mark?
Yes, I hear you, Ernie.
Yeah, okay, good. I'm sorry. Thanks for your astute presentation. My question is, if we're looking now for which of the four places Netanyahu is presently in place, how would you view the appointment of new ambassador to the United States? Obviously, certainly more right-wing than the retiring ambassador, and one who, according to rumor, was clearly involved with attempting to get Romney elected in this country. Does that give you any indication of what Netanyahu was thinking about his relationship with the United States?
Well, the new ambassador, for those who haven't followed this closely, is someone who was from Miami and is a modern Orthodox Jew, and historically, as a very important advisor to Netanyahu, never believed there really was a need for a two-state solution and believed it was a danger. He also has not for quite some time believed that there's a Palestinian partner that can be negotiated with. He emphasized the split between Hamas and Fatah as kind of a hydra that prohibited serious negotiation. And he also has talked about, in rather derogatory terms, privately and sometimes publicly, the performance of Abbas and the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank. So what does this say? Well, he apparently has, in the last 5 or 6 months, struggled to assuage some of the concerns that people in the Obama administration might have. He also, one last thing that was a negative, I suppose, in terms of people are looking for an indicator of whether Bibi is really talking about negotiating in good faith a two-state solution, is this new ambassador also is one of the people that was most central towards politicizing the question of the American election and siding with the Republican presidential candidate in the last election. But he has nevertheless, this candidate successfully politicked in Washington and convinced people that he is open-minded, thinks now that there is, in fact, a binational state threat. All of you who've been listening to Netanyahu have been hearing him steal this Johnny One Note that comes from originally from Shalom Achshav and the peace camp in Israel, and came from politicians, from the center. More and more people say it's a two-state solution or a binational state, and the disaster, it would be a binational state wracked by civil war. It's the kind of war that's a nightmare. And he's one of these people that says, I now am buying into this as well. So all I can tell you is that what seems to be the way people in Washington are talking about the new appointment of the ambassador, well, we'd like to have someone that really does represent the prime minister of the country. And this man obviously is very close to the prime minister, and we were looking, hoping for the best.
Thanks, Mark. Our next question comes from Jim Klutznik, who's the chair of APN's board of directors.
Thanks, Ori. Ernie asked my question, so I'm not going to waste the time. The only thing I'd ask, Ori, is if somebody asks the question you want to, if you're already in line, how do you get off the line?
I'll get you off the line. Don't worry. One thing that I just wanted to add, Mark, to the question regarding the ambassador is that I really think that the best explanation to why he was chosen is the mere fact that the very mundane fact, a prosaic one, that he is the closest advisor to Netanyahu. He's a confidant. Israeli prime ministers traditionally wanted to have someone in Washington who would be a confidant, who they could work with, and I think that that's the best explanation for why he was chosen. I think that really trumps any kind of ideological issue that might be at play here. Our next question comes from, if I'm not mistaken, I think the name was Horn, but I may be wrong. Correct me if I'm wrong.
No, you're right. Phil Horn from
Greater
Metro West New Jersey. I appreciate your analysis. The one thing I do want to challenge you on is what you said about Iran. Did you say that Iran has free elections? And did you further say that the new president...
I did say that Iran just had elections. If I said free elections, I should have said that the outcome of the elections, the person who was elected, was allowed to stay and actually... remain as the president. He wasn't nixed. Three elections, of course, it wasn't, because the clerics were in a position to predetermine who was eligible, and they rendered basically all of the reformist candidates ineligible to run, save this one candidate who was left over as the relative moderate. So you would be right in correcting the impression that these were really free and open elections. What I meant to focus on was the surprise of allowing the candidacy of the one moderate or relative moderate candidate to remain intact and to leave the position in his hands. And obviously this was a clever move by the Supreme ruler.
Yes, it was. And it would seem to me, though, that the one who makes the decisions on these things is Khamenei, and his position hasn't changed in the least.
Well, that may be the case. And raises the interesting proposition, well, what will happen? Will this new president really now agree that Khamenei is the one that decides everything on the nuclear question and on other things as well? This remains to be seen, but I think it's clear that the presumption has been the buck stops with the supreme leader. But the overall question of what input can be made by other people and to what extent the street and the people that voted for the reformist candidate might feel emboldened. So I think this is a reformist potential moment, and I was simply trying to suggest this might change diplomatic calculations and make people more prone to want to test and pursue whether the president, newly elected, can actually carry out some of the promises that he campaigned on.
Thanks, Mark. A quick reminder for those of you who want to take advantage of the very few minutes that we have left to ask a question, press 5-star, 5-star. Our next question comes from Frank Bamberger.
Thank you, Mark, for this excellent analysis. From your talking to Palestinians, do you see any possibility of an interim arrangement with Israel, which is the only possible agreement given the current situation?
The public official line is no, they will accept no more interimism. Interimism is a way of evading the whole issue from their point of view publicly and officially. Off the record, if they were able to get the three things they talk about that are not necessarily nothing is agreed to until everything is agreed to, and I think that's what the question really is. Is there a new negotiating approach here? Because up until this moment, we've been talking about prior diplomacy between the Israelis and Palestinians, presuming that we have to agree to everything before we can agree to anything, because these things are so Jerusalem and refugees can't be held out in abeyance. Well, what we're talking about now on the Palestinian side is they will privately say very clear, if we can get to 67 borders, and privately say they understand it means swaps, so the Israelis will can sell this as something other than exactly the 67 borders, and they can get a settlement freeze, and the settlement freeze they want to have is one that includes where the settlement blocks are and includes certainly East Jerusalem. And so far Netanyahu is not publicly willing to do that. And the third Palestinian demand has been the prisoners. That's critical, and Bibi has made a pre-negotiating concession on that seemingly today. It's not official yet, but that's what I'm told. So I think the answer is they will accept the May 19th Obama approach to it. Will Bibi accept the May 19th approach to it? Or are there parts of the May 19th proposal the president wants to stick to? Don't specifically mention 67 tent swaps. That don't specifically mention. So I'd say that, yes, there is an interimness as long as you deal with the permanent status as it's talked about selectively in the May 19th. They want to pursue the core issues subsequently and have a timeline where refugees and Jerusalem will be talked about. And they want to have a mechanism that would be in place to ensure that there would be a timeline that would be pursued. But first things first, if they're real on security and border, I think the pals understand this is what's on the table.
Thank you.
Thank you. And the next question comes from Jeff. Go ahead, Jeff.
Yeah, Mark, you pointed out correctly that more and more of the government is against a two-state solution and doesn't believe in a Palestinian state alongside Israel. And the corollary is that is more and more people in the government are calling for annexation and even giving citizenship. That seems to be what do you think of those proposals?
Well, first of all, I think that one of the great tests of whether this last election for the 19th government in Israel is whether or not it actually has a minister of justice that is positioned to have an impact on the legislative agenda. So I think that Tzipi Livni has a role on some of the things that are talked about, not exactly towards what you're referring to on the annexation issue, but on some of the legislation that would have an impact on the work that NGOs do. As far as the government people you're talking, people in the government and this annexation process, I think that that's why I mentioned the dubiousness most people have about Bibi's willingness to make peace when he's surrounded with all these naysayers and identified the names and positions of a number of these people. And I then suggested the alternative would be bringing in Shas and the Labor Party, what his own party split. So thinking about the prime minister's own personal position here, to remain prime minister and to be able to move without early elections requires him bringing in Shas and Labor and having the core of his own party remain in place. And by the way, I think the majority of his own party is so absolutely certain about Palestinian inability and unwillingness to pursue peace that they may stay put because they believe that even if Bibi enters this negotiations and is negotiating a border and is negotiating security arrangements, they may believe that Abu Mazen is going to pull out of these negotiations unless he gets everything all at once, and therefore they, the Israelis, will be protected. This may be something that plays to be...
What do you mean protected?
They feel that the negotiations will never go anywhere, even if they start. Let's not break from Likud, let's not leave the government, these right-wingers say, because even if we start negotiations with Abu Mazen, he will and the Palestinians will pull out of them. So we have an ace in our deck. We have an ace up our sleeve, and that is the Palestinians will never negotiate a serious two-state solution with us.
But the Palestinians...
Let's not leave the negotiations at the beginning. Let's let them wreck it. And the blame game should be played cleverly. And this is what they may convince themselves of. Stay in it, because the other side is not serious.
But Abbas sees exactly the same thing on the Israeli side. He sees the Israeli side isn't serious as long as they keep building settlements. So he'll never even start the negotiations.
Well, I think you're wrong. I think there's huge pressure on Abbas to join these negotiations. And I think that they will come up with some minimum satisfaction of the Palestinians in terms of the prisoner issue, in terms of some of the border stuff, on terms of security arrangements. Abbas, if I predict one thing, it would be they will renew negotiations. And as I indicated at the end of my comments, I'm skeptical about whether they will negotiate a substantive enough breakthrough and stay at the table.
Thanks, Mark. And I have promised to you that we will finish on the hour, so we're going to do just that. I thank everyone who participated and people who asked questions, and I apologize to those who didn't have a chance to ask their question. You can, if you'd like, you can email questions to me at onir@peacenow.org, and I will forward them to Mark. Thank you very much, Mark, for participating, and this is the end of our briefing call.